You are listening to the Experience Points podcast for the week of April 10th, 2019, and this podcast is sponsored by the Shinra Corporation.
Welcome back to the Experience Points podcast. I'm George Albor.
My name is Scott Juster.
We are the serious but humanist conversation about, well, the Experience Points podcast is a serious but humanist conversation about video games. That video game today is an oldie, but a goodie.
I've become the podcast, and the podcast is Final Fantasy VII.
Yes, as we have promised listeners in the past, we are doing one of our slow brew debriefs.
Pour over.
Slow brew. Yeah, exactly, man. Venti latte. Fucking tasty, many hours. Chilled.
Nitro podcast.
Only the blackest of brews for you. We're talking about Final Fantasy VII, one of the most popular games in the Final Fantasy VII franchise, and indeed within RPGs and video games as a whole.
Yeah.
We are talking about it today because you and I have been playing it on the Switch.
Yeah, and the deal here is that we've done this with Chrono Trigger, we've done this with Breath of the Wild, we've done this with
Earthbound. Yep. So good.
This is going to be a multi-episode debrief. We're going to just sprinkle them in here or there because it takes a long time to play these games, and also sometimes people have fun playing along, so it's kind of like a book club. It'll give you some time to catch up.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, what spurred it on was that they did a port and a re-release of the three Final Fantasy games to the Switch, and Final Fantasy VII is one of them. So with the renewed interest, we thought it'd be a good time to take another playthrough.
Is the other Final Fantasy VIII and IX?
They did Final Fantasy VII, IX, and I believe they're doing X.
Okay. Not eight, though.
I mean, I don't know what 8 did, but it somehow wronged someone back in the 90s, and it's been fucking buried ever since.
It's because Squall is just too edgy for the modern day gamers, dude.
Yeah, he's so emo that he just can't bring himself to get remade.
Final Fantasy 8 is still my favorite Final Fantasy. Don't at me!
Don't at me. Final Fantasy 8 for life.
For life. Hot take. Okay, so if you are playing along, we are talking about all of the contents of the game through leaving Midgar, which is a big chunk of the game. Of course, this game is super old, so we will be spoiling all of it in our discussions. Yes. Where do you want to start? Do you want to talk a little bit about our experiences in the past with Final Fantasy and Final Fantasy VII in particular?
Yeah, let's do that, because I think it's good just to get the sense of where we're coming from, since it is such a classic game. So did you play it? And this was released in America in 97. Did you play it in 97?
97. I sure did. Man.
Wow.
God, I'm so old. So how old was I? So it's 97. I was born in 84. So I would have been, what, 13?
I was about to say, this. To me, this strikes me as like a middle school or high school game for us.
I think it was like an eighth grade experience. Yeah. And at this point in my gaming career, if you will, I had already played a lot of RPGs. You know, I'd played a lot of the other Final Fantasies, a bunch of other Nintendo RPGs. So I was pretty experienced with it. You know, I knew who Square Enix was. I knew that Final Fantasy was exciting. And yeah, I played it, you know, in front of my screen, probably on the floor where I played all of my video games.
I remember that I did not have a PlayStation. I got a PlayStation relatively late, like maybe 99 or 2000 or something. Yeah. But this was the game where I wanted. I would go over to my friend's house like just to like glimpse this game.
It was a system seller.
Totally. I mean, that and Metal Gear Solid was like, man, I need a PlayStation. And because I, like you, I mean, this was at the height of Square, by this time, Squaresoft's popularity.
Yes.
And I mean, I loved the Final Fantasy series, the secret of games that had come out. I mean, it was just when a Final Fantasy was out there, you know, Chrono Trigger, obviously, fucking Super Mario RPG they made.
It was
an event in the way that JRPGs right now are not events.
Yeah.
And I remember just seeing, I mean, those cutscenes alone, it was just shocking to see like what this kind of freaky looking nerdy series had become. Yeah. And at the time it looked amazing, you know?
Well, and even now it's so striking to me, and it struck me then as well, how different it feels being set in a sort of industrial modern mm-hmm. setting, you know, like the most that you get is like, some of the like gun RPGs, you know, where mm-hmm. there's like weird steampunk, mecha and stuff. But
yeah,
this had a very different feel to it than a lot of the RPGs that were, for the most part, in fantasy settings where, yep. you know, magic was integrated in the world, but it wasn't the sort of like industrial gothic kind of yeah. look and feel of it. And when you're first dumped into Midgar, you know, that is so apparent that the aesthetics are different than what you get out of a lot of RPGs, even RPGs that you play today, that of course it was something thrilling to encounter both as a player and looking at the marketing and talking about it with friends.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, this was, I guess in the context too, like how was this something that you had an opinion on at the time in terms of like, oh, what is the new direction of these types of games or the, you know, or the company or whatever? Like, was it divisive for you that it was in a you know, quasi-modern setting, or that they did go 3D, or that they took away the job system or whatever?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good question, because I don't really remember how I felt about what I realize now is potentially controversial, right?
Like, yeah.
I do remember talking to people, to friends, about the materia system, because I remember that was, and I think still is, like a kind of controversial system, because yeah. some people think that the materia system in Final Fantasy VII is the best magic system that the series has ever had.
Yeah.
And there are others who say it's one of the worst that the series has ever had. So there was, I do remember having a lot of back and forth about what people thought about that. Again, yeah. I actually think the Final Fantasy VIII magic system is pretty cool, but in terms of what I personally remember, I think to be honest, I was probably just enamored with it, because it's such a delight when I was young to just get a new game in the first place, let alone yeah. one that I could spend so many long hours in, you know, yeah. like RPGs, it's a experience that you're signing up for. So yeah. I'm sure that I just was looking at the game with rose-colored glasses.
Yeah. Well, and also just this game was a spectacle. Like, the marketing was a spectacle. Like, they really emphasized, you know, the visual look of it. They, post-release, they emphasized, oh, you know, there's three discs, you know, like,
yeah,
look
oh, at all man, this full-motion yes.
video.
Yeah, I remember the first time opening Lunar Star Story complete, and there's like six discs, and I'm like, this is great.
This must be the best game ever. It's the most game.
Hello, I got the most value for my dollar. This is clearly games of the year. Every games disc is its own game.
Yeah, I mean,
can you imagine today, like, if I opened up it already stresses me out thinking about how long Final Fantasy is going to be replaying it.
Yeah.
Like, if as a grown-ass adult, if I were to open a disc and see, like, six discs, I would just be like, oh, dear God.
You're like, this better be fucking art and, like, high-res assets, because if it's game, I'm out.
Yeah, seriously.
So I guess we can go into the actual structure of the game now, because I do actually want to talk about just how the mechanics of the game work, because it's been a long time since I've played a 1990s style JRPG, as well as what they've done to it in its current iteration, like to mm-hmm. modernize it a little bit.
So I'm not that familiar with what they've changed. I know that they made some adjustments for this version and all of the versions that they've released on like mobile phones and stuff, but specifically, besides the button presses that let you skip battle, instant right. heal and fill your limit break, is there anything else that did they change anything graphically or mechanically outside of that?
I mean, they, to my mind, they, if I'm recalling correctly, because I think this is a port of the version they did for like the PS4 or the PC mm-hmm. or something, they clearly did some graphical work, like in terms of just smoothing out the edges and the character models, because those character models obviously have very little detail, but they're extremely yeah. high
they're
res,
like in a very like weird way. They have way. Hooves for hands.
Yeah. yeah. I mean, it is strange where it's like, oh, you know, this game looked different when it was in a lower resolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think, I mean, for the most part, I actually think it looks pretty impressive. Like the fidelity of the characters themselves, even though there's no texture on any of the polygons or anything, especially in battle, things have a crispness that I was actually fairly pleased with. It's really easy to have, especially those original PlayStation games. Everything was like really jaggy and floaty. Yeah. Like the polygons were just kind of like swimming around the screen in a weird way. Like anti-aliasing was always really strange. So I think the look of it is interesting, but also because they kept the style. Yeah. Like, you know, they did keep the super deformed style of overworld characters, and then the normal human proportions of the in-battle characters.
Yeah, I mean, even the cutscenes are still stand out as like being noticeably different from the aesthetics of the normal game, but are still nevertheless like pretty cool.
I mean, I remember this time around, the entire game really, but even on the visual, just the kind of aesthetics of the game, they were just trying to do so much with it. There are cutscenes where the cutscene ends and then it kind of dumps you into the game and it tries to do it seamlessly to greater or lesser effect. Some of them are a little rough transitions, but some of them are actually kind of cool and smooth. And it's like, wow, like they were trying to do something new. Like they were trying to put the FMV in the game in an interesting way versus just a cutscene.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of narrative bits, like the way that they're cut between like distant memories in the game, or the weird like voices that Cloud hears in the beginning of the game that are kind of neat little like narrative experiments that I can't think of too many games off the top of my head recently that have been that playful with how they are like moving the camera and telling their story asynchronously, I guess.
Yeah. I will also say that I think one of the cool things back when this first came out, and this is also similar to just other PlayStation games of the time, you know, the Resident Evils of the world or whatever, where you had polygonal characters in pre-rendered environments, which looks really good in standard def small CRT screens, but there's clearly those assets have been lost to the sands of time because they have never up-res them.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah.
And so you have this weird difference between the polygons on screen and the super like washed out low res backgrounds, and the cutscenes themselves are clearly shot at a pretty low resolution and bit rate.
Yes, that's true.
And so it's just kind of funny. Like you have this weird Frankenstein of a game where some parts can be modern and other parts, just by the nature of how they were built, are stuck in time and the time period in which they were released.
Yeah. Some of the backgrounds are so detailed, though. It's really bizarre because you're right. It is this weird hodgepodge of aesthetics. It actually kind of reminds me of like the old Fallout games, where it almost feels like some of it is hand-drawn in the background, but then they're just sort of walking over it.
Yeah, exactly. It has the feel of one of those old, 1960s Warner Brothers cartoons or something, or an old Hanna-Barbera cartoon where like clearly the cells of animation are on top of something, on top of a still background.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, exactly.
How do you like the quality of life improvements? Like the what is it? There's no random encounters.
Yeah,
if
no
you
random
flip
encounters.
That on.
Yeah,
you can flip on the insta limit break.
Yep.
And then the 3x speed.
I am one of those people that thinks that if you're listening to a podcast at like 2x speed, you're an animal and you're a horrible.
You hear that, listeners? If you're doing this to us right now,
I already talk fast. Do you really want to do this to yourself? That being so, like, there's a part of me that's like, I go back and forth because there's a part of me that doesn't have it on at times because I want that slow steadiness. Right. But there are other times, and I'm going to be honest, a lot of the times where I just have it on as default because it's a huge time saver in some scenes when you're like, oh, right, I know what I have to do. I have to go all the way back to the start, restart this little puzzle so I can crawl through the air ducts in the right way. Do I really want to go through the incredibly slow animation, even at 3x speed, of crawling through air ducts? No, I don't.
Yeah. Well, and also it's just in these games, there are many encounters where you're like, oh, I know how to defeat this enemy, but it's going to just be a grind. Like, I'm just going to fight a bunch of times, or I'm going to cast the same spell 3x in a row. And being able to do that is amazingly fast.
Yeah, you mean to click on the full Limit Break stuff.
Yeah, click on the full, or just like, there's four enemies on screen. I know I'm going to beat them, but I don't want to use my magic, so I'm just going to keep on fighting for like six turns in a row.
Spam the attack button at 3x speed. Yeah, for sure. Exactly. Absolutely. And I actually have cheated a couple times with the Limit Break. I'm trying to minimize it, but the couple of times I've done it was when I forgot to change out my equipment and been like, oh, yes. I don't have restore magic on any of my characters. At that point, like, fuck it. Like, that's on me, but... Look, these are the systems of a bygone era, right? Like, we don't have that now for a reason. It's because it's kind of tedious and not totally authentic. Like, it just because I forget doesn't mean that a cloud would forget to then go into a battle.
I'm gonna go into this battle, guys.
Just butt naked with like no material. Like, that's insane. Of course he's not gonna do that. So like, I justify in my mind, look, I'm playing the way God intended. So
I'm playing the way Genova intended.
So I'm gonna keep it up. So yeah, I think those moments are totally fine. The not having random encounters, that one I'm actually the most cautious about. Mm-hmm. One, because random encounters slowly build up your experience, and I don't want to get so far that into the game with nerfed experience thinking, oh, I'm underleveled, I'm just going to lean on the crutch that is having instant power. I think that's a very tempting thing to do. So I have not used the no random encounter battle at all. I would rather just push that fight and take care of it at 3x speed than turn off random encounters.
Yeah. I've been doing a similar thing. Like, I definitely, the 3x speed has been the most used thing that I've done.
Well, and then, you know, even thinking back to how I played the game as a kid, eventually you'll find an item that a piece of equipment that lets you avoid random encounters. But I never used that unless I was explicitly experiencing or going back to areas I never wanted to. You know, like if I'm retreading old ground because I thought I maybe missed a story element, like the young version of myself at 13 had all the time in the fucking world over the summer to go through every little piece of content that was in this game. I don't have that luxury now, so I'm probably not going to end up using it. But if I do end up using it, it will be for the same reason I did as a kid.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Same deal for me, too. I also think it brings into relief, though, how mechanically intricate and demanding the games were. Even and Final Fantasy VII was not even, you know, it wasn't like Final Fantasy Tactics or Front Mission or any of those other games that were extremely fiddly, but the game is pretty fiddly. Like, there's a lot of, like, you have to, like you said, you have to swap out your materia. Yep. If you want your materia to have multiple targets, you need to make sure it's in a linked slot to another materia. Yep. Like,
Well, the material will like lower your attack power, so you have to think about that. Yeah,
It's one of the few. It's one of the last Final Fantasy games, I think, that made use of the front row, back row.
I was just gonna say system. Yeah. And in a weird way, I kind of like that because it raises the stakes of the types of encounters you fight. Like, when you have someone in the back row, they're more likely to be targeted if you're ambushed. And so you start to think, oh, okay, well, maybe I'll put two of my guys in the background so they share the punishment, and I'll just put Cloud up front and give him, you know, some protective, the best defensive armor, for example. I like thinking about that from, like, a tactics perspective, and I think the spirit of that continues in things like the Fire Emblem series where you are thinking about, like, turn order and positioning in battle. It's definitely, like, a weird thing to remind myself, oh, right, this is how I used to have to play RPGs.
Yeah. And even down to, like, only being able to save at save. I mean, it's different for us since we're both playing on the Switch where we can just suspend the whole system instead of having to...
But the battery life has me paranoid. So I'm charging my Switch all the time.
Your Switch has never been more powered.
Yeah, exactly.
But, I mean, even that where it's like, oh, man, like, I wonder if there's going to be a save point soon because I'm basically out of potions and ethers, so I need to use a tent.
Yep.
And in the early game, those tents are fucking expensive.
Oh, yeah.
And so, like, I don't want to use them that liberally. So, like, even that is more... I had forgotten how specific that system was.
Yeah, for sure. And even there's so many quality of life changes we don't have now, right? Like, instantly being able to sell items that you no longer need when you buy a new one, right? Or being able to know if someone's not in my party, what items they have. Like, I forget, and I'm like, fuck, do I have to buy this bangle for Eris when I see her again? Like, what is this process that I have to go through to, like, make sure that everyone's the best equipped as they can be? Because you're basically removing everyone's clothing just in case.
Trick question. You don't buy anything for Eris, am I right?
I mean, hey, man, like, she's main party, dude. You got that free full heal? Come on. It is funny. I am actually thinking already now, like, oh, man, who do I use in my full party? Because I remember as a kid, I was very much a Red 13 Tifa player. But now I'm like, maybe I should mix it up.
I was thinking about that. There was, we're jumping ahead a little bit to the story, but there was a point where after you leave Midgar, you have to split up the party, and the dialogue slightly changes depending on who you pick. Mm-hmm. And I just picked, I picked Barret and Red 13. And so
you're like, I don't need to deal with these lady problems.
It was funny because both of them said, they were like, that's interesting. See you later, boys. Yeah. It was just kind of like a funny, like, you are putting these two characters who are basically in a weird love triangle together to just, I guess, go talk. Yeah. You know?
There's some, like, weird comedy in this first part and in the whole game for sure.
It is. It's also just, I feel like it is a holdover of, like, weird 1990s JRPG anime humor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It feels like a comic book in a weird way.
It does. There's a exaggeration to a lot of the stuff that I think is a stylistic choice. Like, I don't think it's just a clunky writing thing. Like, I think a lot of it is style, but
you mean all the melodrama.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, in a way, they're stretching their legs kind of like for Final Fantasy VIII, you know, which is extremely anime.
Where it goes full Final Fantasy Dawson's Creek.
Yes. Like. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about how we played up until leaving Midgar, which this whole section is basically introducing you to the world and the core conflict of the game. So playing this now in 2019, how is the story hitting you?
I think that, so this is perfect timing because I actually have been replaying Final Fantasy IX, which I kind of stopped by. And the way that those two stories kick off in the beginning is so different, just so polar opposites from one another. It's kind of staggering. And they both sort of start in media res, but there is a frenetic pace to Final Fantasy VII that I just love. Like, as soon as you are into the game, you are in it, and the world is weird and different and difficult to decipher. You know, people are throwing around words like Mako and Shinra and Soldier with all capital letters because it's like an anagram or whatever. There's all of these little elements in there. The way that the magic system works, or the train system, or just like the weird creation that almost feels like a Terry Gilliam built city on these huge metal plates over slums. Like, there are these fascinating world building and aesthetic elements to Final Fantasy VII that they dump you into that very few games have the courage to do. Like, even modern day things like Persona 5. Like, Persona 5 also starts in media res, you know, where you're in the action and Joker's running through a casino, but that just holds nothing compared to something like Final Fantasy VII that feels like you're really just dumped into the deep end of a world that is, quite frankly, extremely just dark and weird and almost post-apocalyptic.
Yep. It's funny, I felt the exact same thing where I was shocked by how the game, maybe I'm just in like a weird state of mind these days, but there is a certain relevance and like sense of urgency to this game that I just didn't feel when I originally played it.
Yeah.
And probably part of it is just having lived my life, and part of it is
climate change.
Weirdly. Yeah, exactly. It's like it sounds melodramatic, except that it's not. Like, we are in a situation where we are literally destroying our environment, and this entire game is essentially that story.
Yeah.
Where they're like, there's crazy corporations, they are killing the planet that we live on, and people are too poor and desperate to fight against it. So what are we going to do?
Yep.
And it's like, oof, man, like, you just summed up 2019, bro. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. And I also distinctly thinking as a kid that Barret wasn't that interesting because I think that as a kid, I really wanted to relate to the hero. Right. And that's what kids do. Like, they want to relate to the hero. And Cloud doesn't really have strong stakes in Avalanche's plots in the beginning. You know, like, you're sort of just letting everything wash over you. So I think as a kid, I was irritated by Barret, who's just like loud, brash character.
Yep.
Now, as like, you know, a 30-something adult, I'm like, right. Man, Cloud, you piece of shit. Like, wake up, sheeple.
Right.
Look at what Shinra's doing. It's right in front of your eyes. You know? And, like, Barrett has some sense. And there's these weird little one-offs that are, like, so interesting, right? Like, Barrett mentions that when he's paying Cloud that he needs the money to pay for Marlene's schooling, you know? It's like a tiny little one-off line, but, like, he's a character that has very adult concerns.
Yep.
And it's at a moment in the game where Cloud's being really flippant with his commitment, but... That kind of stuff caught me off guard playing it now to a degree that I'm like, man, I really didn't appreciate how actually mature some parts of the game were when they were dealing with those themes, and how those themes that I think eventually felt quite strongly in the game, especially with the technology and nature relationship as the game goes on, are really pretty well established even within the first like 15 minutes of the game.
Yeah. I mean, it is this weird... It's this weird mixture of pretty heavy, pretty dire themes and circumstances contrasted with, I mean, first of all, like this entire game is basically run through a Babelfish translator, you know? Yep. I mean, the translation is, and I don't mean this to like offend anyone that potentially worked on it, but like it is serviceable at best.
Yeah.
Like it's okay. And not only that, like it's there's just not a whole lot of writing in the game, period. So you do have these like one-off sentences where Barrett is like, well, Marlene will understand. My daughter will understand that I'm not here for her because there's this bigger thing that I have to do.
Yeah.
And
God,
that's
brutal,
like a two-sentence thing. And it's like, man, like that's an extremely interesting, deep character study, but it was crammed into like two sentences that, you know, 13-year-old me probably buttoned through as fast as possible.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I took a bunch of screenshots of Barrett's dialogue particularly because like he was just so stellar in my mind. Like, this guy's great. There's a moment where they are talking about like who's to blame for all of this, and there's a moment where they slip in and go like, man, maybe this is our fault. And then he corrects himself and he goes like, no, it's not us. It's fucking Shinra. They've always been doing this. It's always been their fault. Like, we have to remember that we can't blame ourselves.
Right.
Because this is the point
for
where...
their actions.
Yeah, and this is the point where, basically, and there's a line earlier where they're like, oh, a lot of our actions as eco-terrorists have resulted in people dying. And maybe this is our punishment. And maybe it's our actions that led to Shinra collapsing the plate and basically destroying... a whole slum sector, right? Like, it's pretty heavy shit. Even he swears, he's like, God damn, like, when everything comes down. And he's behaving, too. This is before he knows that his daughter's not dead. Like, he thinks his daughter is dead. And to, like, have and deliver that line, like, there's no voiceover, but, man, that... I felt that because it was, like, some very sincere anger at, like, the people who are actually perpetuating things. And I think the games that capture some of that like righteous indignation the best is our RPGs. The Final Fantasy VIII does this really well, I think, with some of the way that the teens in that eventually rebel against their parents, the parental figures in their life. Persona does it extremely well in every single Persona game, but it's, I think, especially Persona 5. And when you're talking about a subject matter that I think you're right is resonates with themes that we see today around climate change and power holders, I think is fucking great. Like, this is a perfect game to play right now.
I mean, yeah, I was just shocked by how relevant and how well the game had aged from a narrative perspective, which is disappointing because it means we haven't fixed the things that make it resonate even more so now. But and again, it kind of sounds like a backhanded compliment, but I was shocked. I was impressed by it.
Yep.
You know, I was like, man, this held up way better than I thought it was going to hold up.
Yeah, it's pretty nuts. Yeah. Even now, like even the way that they introduce all of the characters, right? Like, Cloud is kind of a shithead in the beginning, and I don't really like him now as an adult. And I don't really know if he's ever going to grow in me in the way that...
Well, that's just because he's such a fucking annoying character in Smash Brothers.
I main Cloud now in Smash Brothers, so...
Fucking classic.
Classic George. But yeah, I think the way that they slowly introduce everybody, you know, Barrett, I think, stands out as a super interesting character. Tifa's, I think, not as well realized. I think they lean really heavily into the love triangle right off the bat, and it's off-putting.
Yep.
She also calls Barrett a retard at one point, and I'm like, that doesn't age well.
It's like, uh-oh, 97.
Yeah, I was like, oh, you know what? On second thought, I think Eris will be my love interest. I think that, but I think the way that they they bring in Red 13 is really cool. I like that character a lot as a kid. I still think he's super interesting because he's this weird alien character, but right off the bat, he fits in. There's this great scene when they're finally leaving Midgar where it's like the superhero lineup. Like, they're all in that group, and they're like, what a weird ragtag bunch of heroes we are. But it fucking works. It feels really great to, like, have that squad together. And I also really like, and I think we'll talk about him more, especially in the next debrief that we do about Final Fantasy VII, where his character is more established. But I really like the way that they seed Sephiroth, because everyone is whispering his name before we know anything about him.
Yep. It's a great... they build it up so much. I don't know. Like, the beats of the narrative are surprisingly modern in terms of putting you right in the action, introducing the characters in a relatively natural way, having this kind of unseen evil that is even more evil than the bad guys that are right in front of your face. Like, they give you two bad guys, one to hate immediately and one to kind of fear for a while. It's just, it feels surprisingly modern in terms of just the story structure.
How much did you hate Rufus? You're like, oh man, I don't even know who this guy is, but he's already a shithead.
I mean, obviously, Rufus, strike one right there.
His name is Rufus. Like,
all that stuff is funny. It's like, it's a bunch of weird, you know, rich corporatist trust fund kids, you know, running around.
Yeah, it was like, I was just listening to the Daily episode about the Rupert Murdoch family, and I was like, Rufus is a Rupert Murdoch family member for sure.
It's classic.
Like, when Cloud is like, oh, Rufus, I didn't finish off Rufus. Where, side note, I was like, damn, Cloud, that's metal. Like, you're just talking about straight up murdering this guy.
And even to draw that parallel even further, there are little side things, like just NPCs in the world are watching TV, and there's like basically state-run, Shinra-run TV that is espousing propaganda for the company, and you know they're kind of calling bullshit on it. It's like, man, it really is like Fox News.
Yeah, for sure. And even the slums, like the slums feel like slums. Like, there's a dude living in like a tube, you know, outside. There's the boxing ring feels like this weird down and dirty like boxing ring.
Everything is improvised, you know. Everything's improvised from cast-offs and garbage and stuff, and people are just making a go at it.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think of course the story resonated with me as a kid and even now, right? Like, I think the Eris's appearance, it's weird now, I think, to think about Eris as a character, and I think we'll probably talk again further about this in the debrief, but of all the characters in just JRPG history, she's one of the most well-known and important characters, right?
Right.
Because of this love interest, but also because of just the arc that she follows and her eventual, spoiler alert, death. That, you know, when you first see her and she's this, like, clearly this symbol for, it's like, you know, the perfect nurturing mother. She's, like, taking care of flowers inside of a church that's bombarded down. It feels a little bit now, looking back on it, as just maybe like a little heavy-handed.
Yeah.
But I could see why that would work then, you know? I could see why it worked for me as a kid, seeing this character and knowing, like, oh, you know, this story is going to be about people from a variety of different backgrounds, from poor, you know, poor characters and people from the slums, like, rising up and playing a fundamental role in making the world a better place. That's a pretty cool message, and it's one that we see in other RPGs, but we also have a lot of hero fantasies where it's like one dude and it's not a group of people that feel like a family, right? Like, there are scenes right off the bat where you are in battles and Cloud's not there because you're having conversations, you're seeing scenes or memories where he's not like a fundamental character. And we talked in our Chrono Trigger debrief a long time ago about how weird it is to have an RPG where the hero leaves for like a great deal of time. But I think that they do a pretty good job of setting up some of the themes around who these characters are that I think a lot of games even today don't do. And I think it's something that is striking even off the bat. You know, we know where how Eris's character arc takes her because we've played this game and it's in pop culture and has been for so long. But I think we can give it a little bit more credit when you just look at what it's trying to do in those early stages.
Yeah. I mean, and they had to do it. They had to do it at a time that games were not, for as broad as games are now, they were ever broader back then, and they had to do it in an area where they didn't have a lot of nuance. They didn't have time to like painstakingly write 10,000 words to, you know, build up a character. So they had to do it quick, and they had to make it obvious. Yeah. And I'm surprised by how subtle they were able to make it, even though they had to be super obvious and super quick establishing these characters, because things did move pretty fast.
Like, case in point, right? Like, the game is going at such a pace that you can basically not interact with Eris when she first shows up, right? Like, you encounter her and she's like, oh, what's happening? And you're like, fuck off, I'm busy, right?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
it's a little bit ludicrous, but I think it's pretty cool that they introduce a character that is so fundamental to the narrative, like, off the cuff.
Yeah, I think so too. I'm trying to figure out if, I mean, because we talked a lot about it, like the story beats are there, the main part, you know, I guess the other thing about the story is that it takes several hours before you even get out of Midgar, and they're doing so much story building and world building at that point. And then the feeling of openness that you get when you get out of Midgar is impressive, because they've kept you in that city for such a long time, and that city is itself dark and closed in, and by its nature kind of hard to get out of.
Yeah.
And so it makes it even more of an event when you hit the overworld screen, you know, multiple hours into the game. And I thought, again, that was just a really deft use of the mechanics to get you to feel how the characters must be feeling leaving this city, where some of them have probably never even left in their entire lives.
Yeah, they say that, like, when you're finally leaving, like, oh, I've never left Midgar. And you're like, Jesus, like, you literally have no sunlight. This is a horrible place to live.
Right.
And it's interesting because you know it's coming, you know, even as a kid. Like, that's just, the open world map is such a fundamental part of RPG worlds that it almost lasts so long as you could believe that maybe the whole game takes place here. I mean, of course we don't now, and we probably didn't then, but it does a really good job of like making the place seem big, right? Like, we see one, two slums, sector six and six, sector seven. Yeah. There's a bunch of other sectors. Like, it would have been, I don't know, I think there's a lot there. Like, it seems like the world is big enough that you could have a pretty sizable adventure without ever leaving Midgar.
Yeah. I wrote something on the site a long time ago about this, but the score of this game is another just like masterful part of it. And I had kind of forgotten, but like, it starts right away. Like, it pumps you into this, like, yeah, exactly. It's like, man, like, this game's not fucking around.
It's really good. I think the music is so good. And I've been playing with my headphones on, and like, it is just crisp.
Yeah. The battle music, the various kind of weird corporate techno marches that they do whenever like Shinra's around. The overworld theme is by far my favorite. It's a extremely like sweeping operatic thing that starts off small and gets really big, and so it's this weird metaphor for how the game even starts, where like, it starts off very closed off and melody based, and then it swells into this huge orchestra just as you're getting out of the city. And it's just a really, I mean, the Final Fantasy composer, what's his name,
Nobu Uematsu?
Yeah, Uematsu. I mean, he's a master, period, but like, but this was just, in a career full of highlights, this is the highlight of those.
Yeah. You know? I mean, you can see why people listen to the soundtrack, you know, or would pay a premium to go see this performed live with an orchestra. I mean, this shit is my fucking jam. Like, I will sometimes finish battles and just like sit there listening to the music. It's so good.
Well, and part of it is like, even the fanfare goes into that more modernized version of it, you know, that they just, like the whole game, they have this really cool balance of classical and futuristic aesthetics, and that translates into the music as well.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good point, because even from a music perspective, it must have been such a challenge. You know, you have this game that does have these sweeping scores that, you know, create feelings of nature and wonder and magic when we eventually get to some of those regions, but you're starting off the game in this really like gothic industrial area. How do you make something that doesn't sound like, I think there's a lot of music that we would associate with this, like, and yeah. and it could have gone bad. You know, it could have been a lot yeah. of like yeah. clinks and clanks and like really mm-hmm. bad, like more industrial sounds, but it's not really like that. And it also, it doesn't lean too heavily on just the like rock and roll aesthetic, right? Like
yeah.
there are even in Midgar, there are moments of really like calm, melancholic music. And then there are yeah. moments of like excitement and being jazzed music. Totally. And it weaves both of those really well.
Do you want to say anything about the plot as like, so basically you've become an eco-terrorist for a while.
You got to get paid, you know?
Yeah. The evil empire strikes back in a big way and like kills, you know, hundreds or thousands of people or whatever, just to try to get at you. You go up to their, Trump Tower headquarters or whatever. And
Trump
and
Tower headquarters
for a while.
yeah.
And then, I thought it was cool how that gets set up, where it's like, man, the world is much bigger and weirder than I thought it would be, because the way they introduce Red 13 is also very funny, because they introduce him as a beast and it ends up, oh, he's a sentient being that's probably older and smarter than everyone in this room.
Yeah.
And then you're out and you realize that, okay, there's obviously this problem of, you know, Shinra destroying the planet, but when they realize that Sephiroth is around stealing back the genetic experiments that for some reason that you don't know yet, all of a sudden Cloud realizes that like there's something much, much bigger going on.
Yeah. I think it totally works. You leave Midgard being like, yeah, we got to go fuck some shit up. I mean, I think Sephiroth's motivations is still a little bit unclear. Again, when we do this next debrief, because I've already played a little bit ahead, like they spend a good chunk of time as soon as right. you leave Midgar being like, here's what we're really talking about with all that Sephiroth stuff. And it's, right. and I think it does eventually work. But I think for giving you exactly what you need to motivate you to get out and align with these guys, it definitely works. I also think, I don't know your thoughts on like Biggs and Wedge and Jesse, who is uh-huh. like all three of them are killed during
yeah.
this match. I think they kind of do a good job of creating characters that you'll be bummed that die, right? Because like Biggs and Wedge mm-hmm. are kind of funny, and they're like, oh, why don't you talk, why don't you engage more, right? And you want to,
yeah,
you know, because you are the protagonist, but Cloud is being kind of a shithead, you know,
right?
And Jesse yeah. is like clearly crushing on you, and so when they die, I think it narratively does a pretty good job of being, oh, you didn't give those characters the attention that you should have, and they sacrificed yep. their life for this cause, you should give your attention to the rest of the party members. And I believe that Kai would make a slight change in the way that he's behaving with the rest of the crew.
Yeah. 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 I mean, overall, impressed with what they did to modernize it. Cause I think it makes it easier to focus on the story, which is clearly what we've focused on
yeah.
in this first episode, but just impressive that a JRPG, which sometimes are not known to be as subtle, the most subtle games in the world, from 1997, seems to have aged extremely well
yeah.
in a surprising way. And that has, it's been a cool thing to get back into.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm definitely excited to keep playing.
I have not done enough homework to know, but for folks playing along, the next debrief will probably be up through maybe through like the encounter with Sephiroth, because you fight.
Whoa, what we do?
I mean, there's a lot of like, there's a lot of backstory. There's a lot of chasing Sephiroth, but then maybe up to the casino. Do you remember that?
Oh, dude, what? The most famous minigame hub in the world.
I mean, that's another thing. Like when you think about the audacity of this game, even escaping Midgar, it turns into like this weird,
the motorcycle on-rails sequence
racing game.
So yeah. weird. Like, what is that? Yeah. That was the one moment where I was like, eh, you know what? I don't think this part has aged well.
But like that, I think that stuff is, that stuff does probably age the poorest because they were trying to do so much in within the constraints of an aging system of, and I don't mean an aging system in terms of the PlayStation. I just mean an aging game design paradigm period.
Yes.
Where it's like, well, we're going to have you do like a stupid stealth sequence here. And now you're going to do a weird on rails racing game here. And now, hey, I heard you like chocobos. You want to start breeding them? Like, sure, there's just so much. There's so many like weird things in this game that they were trying to cram in on top of the already fairly complex battle structure that they put in.
I can promise you these debriefs will come to a screeching halt when I finally make it to the Gold Saucer. Because I, as a kid, like I spent a long time breeding chocobos to fucking race on whatever wacky rainbow road you're doing in that.
Oh my god,
arena.
So weird. Remember, I'm just looking forward to getting to hear that techno chocobo music.
Hell again. Yeah, dude.
Yeah. I mean, I think I have to. I don't know. I have to like do a little bit more playing and research, but I feel like around that is probably where we're gonna check in again.
Yes.
Maybe with a bit more of a streamlined podcast since we've gotten our initial impressions out of the way, but that the story really picks up from here on out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Well. That's Final Fantasy VII Part 1.
Part 1 of the length series.
Yeah. we'll have finished our multi-part Final Fantasy series well in advance of the rumored re-release of
Yeah, I'm glad we're doing this beforehand because then we can talk about what we think needs to change, like what we think is going to come out of that. I am excited.
I know what needs to change. We need to turn it into episodes and sell microtransactions for it.
Oh, good.
You know what'll be? You know what'll make this game
go
better?
Over well. Like a real currency that you have to spend at the Gold Saucer.
Turning it into some sort of live game. Cool. I think we'll leave it there for now. Thank you for listening. ExperiencePoints@gmail.com is our email address.
And ExperiencePoints.net is our Shinra HQ. We're making weird monstrosities out of human beings. They're called episodes of this podcast.
Yeah. Don't look in these test tubes. It's not done yet.
Give them a listen. Every single one.
Cool. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you next week.
Ciao.